And one of the things that he said is these people don't want to come to the ED. They absolutely do not want to. They know it's going to cause them PTSD to go to the ED. And they know that the providers don't want to see them. But if they're choosing to go, it's because they truly believe they are in some level of crisis and need support. And whether or not the ED is the right place, there frankly isn't another place. And so that is a real problem in our healthcare system.
Welcome to In the ED Now, a podcast that makes you an excellent emergency department physical therapist. I'm your host, Dr. Rebecca Griffith, the ED DPT. On previous episodes, we've talked about vestibular disorders and what to do if you have a patient with that type of dizziness. On today's episode, Dr. Nicole Miranda tells you what you need to do to figure out when there's something else going on with a patient's dizziness that's not vestibular in nature. Don't miss this episode of In the ED Now. Thanks for listening. Welcome back to In the ED Now, a podcast that makes you an excellent emergency department physical therapist. I'm your host, Dr. Rebecca Griffith. And with me today, we have Dr. Nicole Miranda. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here today.
Well, I'm so happy to hear from you today because one of the biggest questions that I get from PTs who want to practice in the ED or have practiced in the ED for a long time is they feel like they need help with dizziness. Like if it's BPPV, they kind of got it. But if not, it's kind of a little bit more of a struggle. And I know this is an area you're really passionate about. So can you tell people a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I have a little bit of an interesting background. And I will just disclose that I kind of ride a strange fence, which I think you might do this too, where I've had a lot of personal and family experience that has guided some of my ongoing professional development over the years. So I started out in pediatrics and pediatric traumatic brain injury in particular, and I've always practiced in neurological physical therapy, but I have always remained more of a generalist within the neurological setting. And with that, over the years, I branched into both inpatient rehabilitation, a little bit of home health, and then eventually private practice in a neurological vestibular clinic where I was able to really see anything I wanted. And I've always had a passion for working with amputees. So I am kind of that grab bag mix of people. And so I really like the ability to be able to market what I want to see and to interface with really complicated patients, quite frankly. And I migrated into dizziness in 2002 when I moved here to Colorado and started working for a private practice here that specialized in that. And at that point in time, I had 10 years of experience, but I felt like I was starting my career completely over, getting into the realm of dizziness.
I love that. And so what is it that you do now?
So I exited clinical practice in 2014 because here comes my family story. So my family was affected by a multitude of things, but predominantly dysautonomia. And it was really beyond my ability to address what was going on inside my house and within the clinic simultaneously. And the complexity of care, both in the clinic and my home, was so high that it was just more than I could handle. I've always, not always, I guess since I've been in Denver since 2005, I've been an affiliate faculty at Regis University. And so I upped my time that I was teaching at Regis so that I could really stay engaged more on the academic realm and working with students to keep myself fresh. And since that time in 2018, I joined one of the hybrid DPT programs, South College, based in Knoxville. And in 2020, I became a core faculty instead of an adjunct. And I just in January switched over to full-time with the South College Atlanta program.
Okay, so you've got a lot going on. So tell us what you're working on now as far as how you're going to help people with dizziness. Because I know your personal story took you in some directions you did not expect and brought you to where you are now.
Right. So I have a side gig that I do. I am a startup entrepreneur and a co-founder of an app called DizzyDX. My co-founder is Heather Campbell, who is another lovely physical therapist that has been with me in Colorado for quite some time. We work tremendously well together. And so in 2015, really kind of jointly with when I was sidelined out of clinical practice, I decided to start mapping out how to clinically reason through dizziness. And it started with literally a poster that was a diagrammatic tree of the thinking process. So like a tree algorithm. And so really the short story is that technology has advanced dramatically since we started drawing on paper. And it has become a customized app that we launched in July of this last year. It's been through many iterations and it's been presented at multiple conferences with some beta testing along the way. And we have learned a lot about the development space. So it is a clinical decision support tool for physical therapists to help identify the underlying origins of dizziness, not necessarily vestibular.
Yeah, so I think that's a thing that is hard for a lot of clinicians, especially in the emergency department, because people come into the ED for so many different reasons. Dizziness as a primary complaint is very common. But is it central dizziness? Is it peripheral dizziness? If it's not BPPV, are we done? Do we just move on? Like, how do we know? What are some diagnoses that we need to be looking for in the ED?
So I would say that really more complications that are related to all body systems. So looking at vital signs. I will say globally, in whether it's in an acute care setting or an outpatient clinic or home health, wherever it is, very few people conduct orthostatic vital signs. And they can be so profoundly informative. Whether it is an acute dizzy episode, a subacute, or a chronic, it doesn't matter, because let's just say we can talk about concussion because most people know about concussion. We recognize in the literature and studies that have been shown that patients all have transient dysautonomia after they have a head impact event. For some people, it goes away, and for some people, it does not. We also know now on the backside of COVID that that same experience happens for a large percentage of people post-COVID or post any infection. It could be mono, it could be the flu. It could be lots of different things. And so even people's just an after effect response from anesthesia might set off the autonomic nervous system. And so really being a private investigator with the patients that come in that, you know, maybe they don't have a diagnosis yet, as you're kind of indicating. I know you've interviewed a lot of people that Todd Davenport being one and Helena Esconde, the other one, that talk a lot about the fact that most people see upwards of 5 to 10 doctors before they achieve a diagnosis for some of these dizzy conditions. So that's really important.
Yeah, and I often have patients where they've come in, they've had a stroke alert, they've had a CT, they've had a CTA, they have MRI, and they've had Meclizine, they've had Valium, they've had Zofran, and the docs are like, they can't walk. Like, they're still too dizzy to walk. And I do orthostatics, and I'm like, well, that's because they're having a 40-point systolic drop that they're quite symptomatic. And I feel like we've just spent thousands of dollars.
Yes.
When maybe that was one of the first things that we should have checked. Like, I'm not going to second guess somebody calling a stroke alert based on what the presenting symptoms were at that time. But I think we also need to make sure that we're looking at those things as well, because I think often people are too afraid to do orthostatic vitals with patients like that. But I had my own experience post surgery. I had surgery in November, and I was out with my son, like on my knee scooter, like trying to build my activity tolerance. And I just thought, it is so hard to stay upright. I am working so hard right now. Like, my heart is pounding. I am exhausted. Like, I need to sit down. It wasn't pain. It wasn't nausea. It wasn't really dizziness. I just felt like I could no longer remain upright, and it was too hard. And I finally went home. I checked my blood pressure. It was like 80 over 40. And it was like clear that I had not been managing my well-being. So sometimes it's as simple as like, is your patient dehydrated? That could be causing some of that. But there are people who are living with this diagnosis of dysautonomia all the time. Mm-hmm. So my question for you is, I know somebody out there is like, this is not our job. Why should a PT be even doing this? This is not our job.
So I'm so excited to answer this question.
I know.
So I've been to the ED for this problem, not for me, but for one or both, but actually both of my children. And this runs throughout my family. So I have, again, personal experience, and I can maybe lend a professional bridge to why it's important to know what to do in the ED. So again, I'm going to refer back to Todd Davenport, because he did a lion's share of work for me today and covered a lot of bases. And one of the things that he said is these people don't want to come to the ED. They absolutely do not want to. They know it's going to cause them PTSD to go to the ED. And they know that the providers don't want to see them. But if they're choosing to go, it's because they truly believe they are in some level of crisis and need support. And whether or not the ED is the right place, there frankly isn't another place. And so that is a real problem in our healthcare system. And so maybe, like, first of all, recognizing that and putting that in your back pocket, that like this person's desperate and they don't have anywhere else in our system to go. And then really what I would say that a PT could do is to help uncover, like, why are they here? What is it? Like you said, they're not regulating themselves. Why aren't they regulating themselves? And what short private investigator work could you do to help uncover the why or how with them? And, you know, again, Todd mentioned, don't tell these people, ask them, because they know. They know their bodies. They know where they're failing. They know oftentimes somewhat what the problem is. And it may be that they can't get into their regular providers for upwards of 6 months or 2 years for follow-up visits. And so PTs can be really instrumental at uncovering some things and helping with that referral process. Obviously, they're not going to do follow-up in the ED, but to be able to get them to somebody else that has interest in this area to help them along the way, whether that's actually seeing that they're having some skin reactions or other signs of an immune response that's being unregulated. That's obviously not something that is heavily screened for in the ED unless there's an EpiPen involved, I don't think. And then the other one is, again, looking a little bit more heavily at the orthostatic intolerance. You commented in some of your interviews that even when neurology comes by, they oftentimes don't really, they clear somebody neurologically, but they don't physically see how the person is performing. And so trying to help elicit some of the stress responses that are causing this flare, if you call it, is very, very helpful and validating for the person that they're not indeed crazy. They actually have a reactive body system that they don't know. They're not equipped with how to calm it. So I'm sorry I keep wiping my nose, but I have mast cell activation syndrome and I have these allergies. And so no matter what, if I time a Zoom call, my nose is going to drip.
It's totally fair. So I love your point about that somebody needs to be mobilizing these patients and seeing what's happening. And oftentimes I find with PTs in the ED, I have to be like, hey, like, I know their blood pressure's high, but you need to stress their system anyway. And if their system is going to be stressed, this is where that needs to happen. I would argue with patients who are having some dysautonomia and POTS, sometimes it's also incumbent on us to stress their low system a little bit also while they're in a safe environment so that we can say to the physicians, hey, like, if I get this person on the stairs, their blood pressure is dropping even further. Like, that doesn't feel like they're safe to go home right at this time. And of course, doing that in collaboration with the patient, like if they don't feel comfortable doing that, obviously we're not going to do that. But I think that you can't examine these patients properly if we're not already also getting vitals with mobility, not just standing at the bedside.
Right. I don't know how much you know about this, and I'm happy to provide some references, but there is an autonomic symptom score called the Compass 31 that was developed at Mayo Clinic. Super helpful. It is a quick questionnaire, and it has 6 domains, and it really helps to identify which domain the orthostatic intolerance is kind of presenting in. You probably know that a lot of people that have dysautonomia have massive GI dysfunction, and it can be hard for them to put that into words. Some of them have really difficult issues with pelvic floor. Their bowel and bladder significantly changes. And depending on the age group that you're talking about, we have a wide range here. This could be very common in teenagers, can be very common in college students, but we can also see it as an overlay with Parkinson's or other different disorders that present in older adults. And so, you know, asking a college male about their bowel and bladder function, probably not going to go over super well in the ED. But if you give them this Compass 31 score to help try and identify, like, where is the flare coming from, it can help you to quickly stream, like, where should the referral be directed at? And can help maybe even sidetrack some of the, you know, these patients are, I'm going to use the word blamed for catastrophizing, and they get kind of lumped into the psychiatric domain diagnoses. But if you can search a little bit harder for where the physiology is, I promise you it's there. And it can just really help you to determine, it could be pupillary function. So if you look at somebody who is exhibiting papilledema, like, is there an indication for a neurology referral to get a lumbar puncture done where there is actually a dysautonomia panel that can be done with a lumbar puncture to look at antibody markers that might be associated with some genetic reasons why somebody is sinking in this pathway and not responding to, like, the, I'm sure you've heard of the drink water, wear compression socks and eat salt kind of algorithm for POTS or dysautonomia that does not work for somebody that has immune reactivity or genetic problems.
I think that all makes sense. I think oftentimes it's going to be really difficult to, like, nail down that diagnosis in the ED, but I think it's helpful for people to know that that exists and make that referral process a little bit better. And if you are listening and you're like, gosh, I don't know that I can ask my patients about bowel and bladder symptoms, I would encourage you to go back and listen to our episode with Dr. Christina Holland, who is a pelvic floor therapist. She really talked about best ways to screen for that in the emergency department, including patients who are having fall risk. And we can add patients with dysautonomia to that list as well.
Yeah. And that category on the Compass 31 could answer that. You don't have to ask the questions if you, if they fill out the survey and they hit all those items. So that's really, really helpful.
So who should we refer these patients to?
Well, obviously that depends on where you are. So I would say that when I've talked to other people in emergency departments, that is the problem. Like, how do we build our network of providers that we can refer to? How do we discover the people that are interested in this area? And, you know, I think it depends, again, like, if this person is having signs of a mast cell reaction, which is like an early anaphylaxis, there's new consensus guidelines on the fact that only two organ systems have to be involved. So the person could actually have a mild rash anywhere on their body, and they could have heart palpitations, and that would constitute a mast cell reaction. Mast cells can act like a primary disorder of any system in the body because they are in every system of the body and they're part of our normal immune response. So allergy and immunology might be a big hit for some people.
Okay.
And really just across cities, it's very different about how neurology, rheumatology, cardiology, gastrointestinal specialists, what their kind of touch point is with dysautonomia and which ones of them have interest in this area. The number one place to tell a patient to go is to social media. And I know that sounds absolutely crazy, but there are thousands, if not millions, of people that follow organizations like Dysautonomia International on social media. And every single state has a support group through Dysautonomia International. They're closed private support groups. I help moderate the one for Colorado. And I will tell you that people vet therapists, doctors, ERs, everything on social media, and they write all about their experiences. When I started this journey in roughly 2014, 15, the things that I read about physical therapists and other healthcare providers made me want to leave my career.
Oh no.
Now, when I go on there, I actually get lists. There's Google Docs of who to go to at which facility, who to see, who's helpful, what their experience has been. I would say hands down to actually tell people to hit social media, Facebook in particular, that's where those files are.
So, okay. What kind of physical therapist sees patients with mast cell or dysautonomia?
Anyone who has interest in it. So typically I tell people to start, if they're doing a Google search, and I help people find therapists around the country all the time. I'm like a connector. So if they tell me what zip code they live in, I just start searching zip code. And I actually typically look for concussion clinics first, because if they do concussion, they kind of have a touch point with dysautonomia. About a third of people that have dysautonomia have also been linked to having connective tissue disorders on the hypermobility spectrum and mast cell disease. They call it a trifecta. And so typically, if you see somebody in concussion, they might have gone to some kind of continuing education or seen patients or taken an interest in reaching out and learning a little bit more about this population. And then I remind patients, you know, you can call and you can ask the front desk, how many of your therapists work with people with dysautonomia, and ask, like, actually call and ask what services they offer. And sometimes I'll give people two or three recommendations, and I'll tell them, call and vet them, interview them, and see what they offer. There are a lot of therapists out there seeking more information about these topics. Again, in Facebook, there are private groups of physical therapists, occupational therapists, and speech therapists that separately have interest in chronic fatigue, ME, and POTS. And some of those providers are interested because they have been affected or they have family members that have been affected, like myself, and they contribute resources openly on social media to help get information disseminated and out to help patients in the community.
I think that's an excellent resource. I know I've learned a lot just from connecting with people on Twitter and connecting with people on social media, just because you can present at CSM. Maybe 50 people will come to your talk, maybe even 200 or 300. But still, when you think about the number of therapists there are in the country, like that's, you're not even quite skimming the surface there. So I actually think it's a really good way to disseminate evidence-based practice. And when we're talking about an area like this, like sometimes the evidence might not be keeping up because of misdiagnoses, because it's hard to find patients who are willing to participate after they've been burned by the healthcare system a few too many times. So I can see why that would be more of a challenge.
Yeah. So speaking of CSM, I am presenting with Janine Holmberg and Clayton Powers, who are both in Utah, and we are presenting dizziness, chronic dizziness, spinning out of control, and we are actually looking at the diagnosis of 3PD and the need to actually screen dysautonomia out before you assign the diagnosis of 3PD and chronic dizziness, and really going over the orthostatic vital signs and talking about immune reactivity and mast cell activation during our talk at CSM.
That's awesome. Is that going to be on demand?
It is going to be on demand.
Great, because I think this episode is going to air after CSM, so I want to make sure if you're listening to this now, you know where you can get that information. So if somebody's listening and they're like, what is 3PD?
It is a chronic dizziness. It is persistent postural, persistent postural perceptual dizziness. So it's evolved over time. It's had lots of different names. Basically the criteria are for somebody who has been dizzy longer than 3 months and that their dizziness is worse upon standing or being upright. And that there is no longer, if there was an event that caused it, such as a vestibular problem like unilateral hypofunction or BPV or something like that, that has resolved. And so the dizziness is no longer really correlated with that vestibular event. And sometimes there is not an identified event. And so it's kind of a cluster of criteria. There is a diagnostic criteria for it. It is often associated with having an elevated kind of state of anxiety, and it's been recognized to have a presentation of a higher level of sympathetic tone. And so we are kind of reflecting upon that diagnostic criteria in our talk and talking about, you know, maybe there is a bigger need to look back at something like vital signs. I mean, based on what I just described, that's the same thing that people experience with post-concussion syndrome.
Yes.
Which is diagnosed after 3 months and is considered a chronic condition. And some people have dysautonomia with that, and it leads to a prolonged recovery. So I think what's important then is talking about how you select your treatment based on whether or not the person is experiencing orthostatic intolerance, because for 3PD, a lot of the treatment points to cognitive behavioral therapy and the use of some anti-anxiety medications. And if you give someone those medications and tell them to kind of, you know, work through some psychological interventions to overcome this problem, but there is an underlying immune trigger or an underlying ANS trigger that is causing this to be persistent, it's not going to be addressing the problem.
Maybe addressing a different problem, but not making that dizziness better. And to be honest, if I were like constantly dizzy, I would probably be really anxious myself.
Absolutely. And there's certainly a role. Falling. Yes, there is certainly a role for things like cognitive behavioral therapy or other types of, you know, mindfulness, meditation. Some people, I mean, everybody finds what works for them, which again, yeah, speaks to just any kind of chronic illness. Like you really have to partner with the person and see what's valuable to them and what they respond to. Like not everybody responds to the same thing. And so there's definitely a role for ancillary therapy support. But I think what's important is trying to identify what the person's functional goals are, what the limitations are, why they can't do it, what are the other impairments that are stopping them from doing it. Again, in the 3P diagnosis, these people also have visual motion hypersensitivity, which also goes along with things like concussion. And of course, if you haven't been active and you haven't been moving and you haven't been exposing your vestibular system or your somatosensory system to activity, then you're going to become more sensitive.
Yeah, I would think that it would just feel worse. I can also see the potential for, if you do that, you go through all the cognitive behavioral therapy and you take the medication and you journal every day and you do mindfulness and it's still not getting any better. I feel like if I were the patient, I would feel like, what am I doing wrong? Why am I failing? And I would think that that would just be so damaging also.
Right. Well, another thing that's really important, we kind of touched on this before, but the whole kind of integumentary screen that we can do, whether it's in the ED or otherwise, the integumentary system provides a lot of insight into whether or not somebody is having a mast cell reaction. A lot of people will be able to tell you that they have skin reactions and with their flares that are not consistent. Some people will even have what seems like a UTI, but it's really inflammation of the ureter and it's presenting as cystitis and it's not an actual UTI. So they'll keep going in and they'll have negative urine test for bacteria to identify an infection. And it's really just mast cells that are aggravated causing the problem. And so again, trying to help people understand what resources they could use. Mast cell reactions, the testing for them has to be done within 2 hours of the beginning of an allergic reaction. Most people have no idea it's happening within the 2 hours. So the two tests you would do would be a serum tryptase, blood draw, or a 24-hour urine catch that has to be started within that 2-hour timeframe. The 24-hour urine catch is really hard because the urine has to be refrigerated during the entire 24 hours. It has to be centrifuge refrigerated, and there are not many labs that know how to process this. So people who have this problem, which is identified as being at least 17% of the population, they get a very high false or negative diagnosis because of the challenge of the testing. So the new consensus guidelines show that what you should do is just identify that, again, there are two organ systems involved in some kind of allergic response that is kind of like an early anaphylaxis kind of response. And some of the treatment recommendations for that are simply over-the-counter antihistamines. So people have to take H1 blockers, which are the sinus system. So that typically people will take Zyrtec twice a day. The label on the bottle says that 10 milligrams is a 24-hour dose, but the dose that you take over the counter for mast cell activation is twice a day, morning and evening. And then they will also take a twice a day H2 blocker, which is a GI antihistamine. So a lot of times people take Pepcid twice a day. So if they can't get into an allergist anytime soon, and if they're not making traction with anything, but their body is just generally reactive, you can ask them to talk to their pharmacist, to put a call into their PCP and say, do you think it's safe for me to get these two over-the-counter medications and just start taking antihistamines? It does not work unless you're taking it all the time, twice a day, to offload that histamine level, because the mast cells are just out of control, degranulating and causing these reactions throughout body systems. If while they're waiting for an appointment with a follow-up physician and they notice a positive response to the antihistamine therapy, they've already made a step in the right direction. They've done their own research. They've taken charge of their own system and their own body. Once they get past that point, there are prescription medications that can be added, but getting that first validation that this is my immune system doing something is really so helpful for both the patient and saves the provider a ton of time.
Yeah, a little bit of hope.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. So if we're in the ED and we're pretty sure this is the cause of dizziness, whether it's mast cell, dysautonomia, POTS, or like some combination of all of that, or you even post-concussive syndrome, whatever the cause might be for these specific symptoms, how do I confidently decide if somebody is safe to go home? Because I know that this varies a lot, like wildly. And if I see them right now, they might not be safe to go home. If I see them in a couple hours, maybe they are. Like, how do I make that decision to pull the trigger? Because the team is looking to us to say, this patient cannot go home because they're unsafe. Or they're looking to us to say, this patient has to go to rehab. Like, how do we make those decisions? Like how can we be confident that we're doing the right thing for the patient?
Well, I think certainly the level of distress and the ask from the patient is key. So some patients will come to the ER specifically asking for IV hydration. And there's a good amount of research that shows that that is absolutely necessary in a lot of cases. And some people do IV hydration on a regular basis. They have trouble initially getting an order or finding a location that can meet that need. So if they are in crisis and need IV hydration, that can be a game changer. So that's one thing that can be tried. I know Todd Davenport also talked about that. I just want to mention that the infusion rate for these people is really important. Because if you just open a bag of IV hydration, they're going to get it all in their third spacing and they're going to bloat and feel worse. So there is a specific infusion rate that should be used for this diagnosis. And I can provide you with some literature to help support that. I think that if gastroparesis is a problem and if it's a critical problem, and some people will tell me, you know, we like to label things. So some people will be told they have anorexia. Oftentimes they don't have like true anorexia, but their symptom burden is so severe that they have no drive to eat and they're not digesting food properly and it's absolutely painful. So if GI is their major problem, then, you know, I would say it's not PT's role to make that decision. I think that's pretty clear. As far as like the safety issues and mobility stuff at home, I think making sure that they've had proper education on the amount of fluid that they should be taking every day, which is typically 1 to 2 liters of additional water. Some people go overboard with that and then they become hyponatremic. So making sure that they're also doing the sodium intake, educating people about what are good electrolytes to drink and how much of an electrolyte should you drink every day. Educating them about the sugar content of some electrolytes as being kind of an adverse effect and sticking to things that are lower in sugar, which would typically be like the noon tablets or the liquid IV powder. It's a really good idea sometimes to just put those things in your glove box, put them everywhere so that you have them wherever you travel. Knowing that they have a rescue plan, like what is your rescue plan? Asking them that, like, how do you rescue yourself? And making sure that they do have this basic information. I have created some fact sheets for the Academy of Neurologic Physical Therapy, and I would be happy to help develop some kinds of things that might be useful for the ED. I can't say that it's, you know, my environment. So I would certainly lean into you to help determine what's the most appropriate.
Oh, that's perfect. Okay, so that's a lot. And that's why you made this tool, right? To help physical therapists with their clinical decision-making. So if somebody listened to all this and they're like super overwhelmed, we'll have some resources in the show notes, but tell us a little bit about how people might access that tool and how they could use that and implement it in their facilities.
Sure. So dizzydx.com is available on the web right now. You can subscribe for an annual subscription. If you're a student, there's a discounted rate compared to a professional. We also can work with institutions if they want to provide it as an educational benefit for their staff. When you enter the tool, you get to build your own cases inside the tool. So let's say you see one of these complicated patients in the clinic and you're not really sure what to do. It has two different, we call them journeys, that you can take. The symptom journey has 12 different ways that we describe dizziness. So in the context of something like dysautonomia, people might use the word lightheaded. They might use the word foggy headed. They might say that they have head pressure. These are all choices that you can choose in the app. When you choose one of these, it offers you clinical presentations, like does it happen when they stand versus lying down? Is it position change oriented? If you choose that particular clinical presentation, so to speak, then it offers you hypothesized impairments that might be causing that. And you will see things like dysautonomia and POTS pop up on the impairment list as you move through the app. There are clinical reasoning prompts, critical thinking prompts that pop up in the front end symptom part of the app. Those thinking prompts are all referrals. Should I refer this patient out? Well, this patient's already in the ED, so you're out of luck. You're stuck with the patient until they get discharged, and then you might make that referral post emergency room visit. When you get to the impairments section of the app, it again describes the impairments. It gives you alternative impairments that oftentimes travel alongside these. So let's say you pulled up dysautonomia POTS, it might also pull up orthostatic hypotension. It might pull up 3PD. It might pull up different things that travel kind of in this network. And then it will offer you clinical tests that should be performed, and it will offer some guidance on critical thinking action items that you might need to do to rule in and rule out those different clinical tests to add them to your case summary. At the end of the app, it provides you with a summary of your case, and it walks you through a confidence interval so that with all the impairments you think this person might have, you get to rank those impairments in terms of how prioritized they are, that they're a part of this person's dizzy experience, which would ultimately help you if you were in the clinic to develop a treatment plan. Now, that's beyond the scope of the ED, but in general, that's what it would offer a clinician, is just some guidance and help narrowing what is that highest priority problem right now that's driving this situation. And then you would, in theory, repeat that process with nearly every visit, because people's symptoms change every single visit and the priorities might shift. If you treat something really well, or if it doesn't respond, you might have to pivot.
How long on average does it take to do that?
Actually, most people, it only takes a few minutes, like less than 5 minutes to go through a case. It's more just the fact that it's not something that you would do in front of a patient. Sure. It is currently meant for right now, like after the patient, or, you know, in the ED, the patient doesn't go anywhere. So you could do this while the patient was still in the ED. If you kind of did a cursory exam and you kind of looked at a bunch of things, you could jump on and you could go through the app and be like, what am I missing if I think it's dysautonomia or POTS? And there are, I think close to 200 now references cited in the app to support the clinical reasoning as you go. So if there's an article of interest that you want to pull up, it tells you right there where to go look.
That's perfect. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. Like, what are your parting thoughts for PTs who are helping patients with this?
I'm really excited. I'm really excited that PTs are in the ED, because I think that they can change the experience of the patient. I think that obviously the population of people that I'm talking about are not the most critical people in the ED at all. And if you have triaging going on and whatnot, I think that, you know, there's obviously trauma and other critical events like MIs and CBAs that need physician attention. And so if there's a role for nursing and PT to be kind of co-involved in helping provide education and stabilizing people and giving them hope and just getting them ready to take back on their own self-care. I mean, we know people live in crisis, and nobody has malintent when they go to try and get help. And so I'm hopeful that we can partner with people to help jointly learn more, do better, and offer more.
I love that. That's perfect. Thank you so much for being on the show. You've been in the ED now and you're officially discharged.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. In the ED Now is a podcast hosted and produced by Rebecca Griffith, the ED DPT, as part of Rebecca Griffith Physical Therapy, LLC. Our podcast makes you an excellent emergency department physical therapist. This podcast is intended for educational use only and is not intended as clinical or medical advice. While we make every effort for accuracy, factual errors may be present. Since you've been in the ED, I'm prepared to give you your discharge instructions. Please subscribe, share, and find more at theeddpt.com. You're officially discharged.